Thank you very much for that kind introduction. I also want to send my deep appreciation to Kayla Eisenbach for making all the arrangements to have me come here today. I greatly appreciate it. It's truly a pleasure being here. And when I was getting up at 3:30 this morning to get to the airport in time to make my flight, I was thinking that it's also a little bit of a kapara perhaps for the Cubs, so I extend my apologies for what happened with them. Being a lifelong Met fan, it's only appropriate that I should suffer a little bit today. There you go. Anyway, this is actually the second time I've been here, and I do appreciate being invited back. The last time I was here, I spoke on a related topic, a topic that focuses on the mind-brain-soul conundrum, how they're all related from a Torah perspective. And I figured that when I was invited once again to come back and speak here, that perhaps it would be appropriate to give what I consider to be sort of a companion talk related to the original talk that I'd given here a number of years ago. And this talk focuses more generally on the topic of life. And in such, it's actually, in a way, an appropriate companion piece to the beautiful shiur given by Rabbi Ries just previously, which, again, I'm very grateful I had an opportunity to hear. In particular, I'd like to try and understand what life is really all about from a Torah perspective. And doing that, taking initially the perspective very different than Torah perspective, the perspective of synthetic biology. Now, you might be wondering, what exactly is synthetic biology? A lot of people ask that question, including many people in the field. I'll try and give you an example of what synthetic biology is all about by going through a few milestones in its history. Back in the year 2002, scientists at Stony Brook University, out on Long Island, not far from me, made an astounding announcement. They reported that they had synthesized the complete genome for a virus, the polio virus, and they did it by looking at the published sequence of nucleotides. Again, DNA consists of nucleotides arranged in specific order. They looked at the published sequence and then just buying chemicals off the shelf, so to speak, chemicals that are easily obtainable, the various nucleotides. They strung them together like beads until they had finally completed the 7,700 base pair complete genome of the polio virus. It was an astounding announcement. It took them about 2.5 years of painstaking effort to accomplish this. That was back in 2002. The next year, in 2003, another group of scientists at the J. Craig Venter Institute announced that they too had synthesized a viral genome. This time it was a different virus. It was a bacteriophage, PhiX-174. And it was a little bit smaller than the polio virus. It was only about 5,300 base pairs. But instead of 2 years of painstaking effort, they did it in 2 weeks. So there was a significant advance in the technology in the course of that single year. That same group at the J. Craig Venter Institute in 2006 announced that they had done something new. Everybody, of course, was impressed that they had synthesized the genome of a virus, but a virus, many people don't even consider viruses as real living organisms. Some people view them as just very complicated large molecules, not necessarily life itself. So what these scientists did was they synthesized the genome for a bacterium, a much larger, much more sophisticated organism. What they did was they began with the genome, again, using that as a model, the genome of a known bacteria, Mycoplasma mycoides, and they tried to synthesize it. It consisted of about 316,000 base pairs. They removed about 45,000 base pairs, genes that they considered to be unnecessary. Oh, thank you. Genes that they considered to be unnecessary. They also inserted a number of their own genes that would enable them to control how the bacteria would grow, what it would do, and also that would include markers that would enable them to identify this bacteria and distinguish it from others that might also be growing, which could be potential contaminants. On top of that, they inserted what they referred to as watermarks in the bacterium genome. They developed a code using the sequence of nucleotides, as they would spell out various amino acids and so on, that basically corresponded to the alphabet, and they inserted all their names in the genome of this thing, as well as their, I don't know, their favorite pets or whatever else they chose to include.
The Mets.
The Mets, yes. Now, that I don't think they included. And they announced that they had synthesized this huge thing. A few years later, in 2010, they announced that they had taken this genome, this bacterial genome, and they had inserted it in the body, in the cell, of a related bacterium species. This one was called Mycoplasma capricolum, which had its own DNA completely removed. It was completely devoid of genetic material. They took this DNA, this genome, they inserted it into it, and they were able to get this bacteria to reproduce normally and to act normally under their control. Right? It was considered a major, major accomplishment in the world of synthetic biology. It prompted all sorts of bioethics symposia, including some that were sponsored by the White House because people came frightened at the consequences of this. But other people said, all right, what did they do? They managed to synthesize, or at least the genome, if not the entire thing, of a bacteria. But a bacteria is a bacteria, right? It's not a eukaryote. It's not something with a nucleus. It's not a more complicated organism. Last year, in 2014, a group of undergraduates, college students, taking the Build Your Own Genome course at Johns Hopkins University, reported that they completely from scratch synthesized one of the 16 chromosomes that are found in the eukaryotic cell's yeast, in yeast cells. And when they abbreviated it, they got rid of redundant genes, they inserted it into other yeast where it replaced the chromosome that they had modeled it after, and those yeast reproduced normally and functioned perfectly normally like any other yeast. Also last year, another group announced something that, again, in the world of synthetic biology was considered to be possibly even more astounding, more peculiar. They reported again that they, in this case, they were working again with bacteria. But there are four, of course, natural nucleotides. And one thing that pretty much every single living organism in the entire planet has in common is that we make use of the same nucleotides to form our genetic material, and that we all follow pretty much the same genetic code, with a few odd exceptions. What they did was they synthesized two completely artificial nucleotides. These were not found in nature at all. And they substituted them for two of the natural nucleotides in a bacteria. The bacteria was able to absorb it. It was incorporated into its DNA, and it reproduced 24 times before stopping. The only reason it stopped, apparently the DNA was able to replicate normally with the new nucleotides that they had created. But it was unable to translate to produce messenger RNA and to produce protein, so it couldn't continue to manufacture itself. In the world of synthetic biology, that's viewed as a tiny little technical problem. Don't be surprised as the years go on when you hear more and more astounding things. It's not going to be long before you start hearing of synthetic biology labs creating eukaryotic cells from scratch, the entire genome. There are many groups that are already working on it. There are right now literally dozens of synthetic biology labs around the world working on the process of creating life. Hundreds of scientists. There are regular meetings that are devoted specifically to this topic. Why do this? If you look at the top of the sheets that I've handed out, or that I provided, and actually I apologize, you've got the microscopic print ones. This is the way they originally looked, but I couldn't get my scanner at this scan it in a big piece. I'm technologically not very adept. And so I had to shrink it in order to send it to Kayla to produce here. But I'll read the things that are completely illegible on it. But if you look at the very top of the sheet, there's a quote from the physicist Richard Feynman. "What I cannot create, I do not understand." And this is the usual rationale given for synthetic biology. The belief that if we can create life, we can get a better, deeper, more precise, more exact understanding of all the processes that are behind, that are responsible for life, and that enable life to go on. In addition, there are practical reasons. Right now, scientists work very hard at trying to adapt nature and then to use it to create new pharmaceuticals, biofuels, all sorts of things that are for people's benefit, largely relying on what's found in nature for models or modify it in some relatively simple way. With synthetic biology, all the restrictions are removed. The only thing that limits us is our imagination, our ability to see things. As we get deeper and more precise understandings of the way molecular interactions occur, we can design living organisms to do exactly what we want. And this, again, is part of the promise. Synthetic biology, by the way, is not exactly a new field. It's believed to have originated back in the Neolithic period when people first began to domesticate both plants and animals. Virtually everything you eat is a product of synthetic biology, comes back from the domestication. Very few of the vegetables, for example, or fruits that you eat are found naturally in nature. These are things that have been, through all sorts of husbandry and so on, these are things that have been manufactured by our ancestors over thousands of years. What we're doing now, though, is we're taking a very dramatic step. We're going to the point where it's no longer are we content with manipulating life, manipulating living things, but we're in the process of creating life, creating living things. And I could tell you, it's frightening to a lot of people. I mean, there are certain very basic ethical issues, which is what prompted that big White House bioethics thing after they had produced that bacteria. For example, if you can create viruses and bacteria, you can create all sorts of pathogens. You can create very dangerous organisms. They can be weaponized. Or, forget even malicious intent, they can be used, they can be released accidentally. Accidents happen, as we all know. And who knows what the consequences would be? All sorts of things worried people in terms of the basic ethics. What about designer babies? You can manipulate the human being. If you could do that, then why not create children who are perfect in every way? They're good-looking, they're intelligent, they've got all the various milas. Of course, keep in mind this will probably be an extremely expensive process, and what you end up having is one group that's been genetically engineered, and then the rest of the group that sort of has to, you know, leave it up to nature and to chance to determine what their children are going to be like. You can use your imagination to see where such a thing might extrapolate to. So these are some of the ethical issues that people have raised. Most common, though, one of the most popular, I should say, ethical issues or problems that have been raised associated with this is something very fundamental, very basic. It comes from the gut. It's a gut reaction to it. Are we going too far? Are we playing God? Is this an example of human hubris to think that we can go out and we can manipulate and create life, something that always is something that we've attributed entirely to God? Can we go ahead and do that? And going beyond that, there's another issue. It has to do with the whole concept of reductive materialism, something the last time I was here I spent a lot of time speaking about. From the perspective of the reductive materialists, you and me, your friends, your neighbors, your family, everybody, we're no more than complicated machines. That's all we are. Our movable parts, our working parts are, you know, are molecular in their scale, and perhaps cellular on certain levels as well. But when you get right down to it, we're no more than big, complicated molecular machines that can be built at will, like anything else, like your car, like your air conditioner, like anything else. And What does that do to the notion of sanctity of life? What is that? What happens to the issue of sanctity of life? There's a story I like to tell over, for a number of the different talks that I give, about an incident that happened years ago. I was invited to give a talk at a symposium that was held at Stuyvesant High School in New York. It's a very, very prestigious elite high school of sorts in New York City that was located just a few blocks away from the World Trade Center. And I happened to be invited there in the year 2000, shortly after the 9/11 incidents. And the topic of discussion was stem cell research. And I was invited actually wearing two hats. I was invited, first of all, as a medical researcher who's done stem cell research, as a neurologist who can understand some of the clinical implications of stem cell research, but also as someone who could represent a Jewish halachic perspective as far as stem cell research is concerned. And the rest of the panel consisted of all sorts of other individuals. There were bioethicists, there were religious folks, there was, in fact, with the priest who was on the panel, who was representing the Catholic perspective, was actually the chaplain for the New York City Fire Department, and had just spent the last few months going to one funeral after another, after another, after another, of the various firefighters who were killed in the World Trade Center. And after we had each gotten up and given our little spiels and, spoke whatever, it was that we thought that we should be saying in this symposium, they opened up to questions from an exceptionally bright group of high school students. And the very first question we got was from this, very young Asian woman who gets up, or woman, it's girl. She's very very petite. She comes up very shyly to the mic, and then she says, "You keep banding about the term sanctity of life. What does that mean, sanctity of life? Based on everything I've been taught, life is no more than a series of biochemical reactions. What is sacred about that?" And you know what was the worst part of it? You had all these experts on the panel and nobody could answer her. Nobody was able to give her an intelligible answer. But it got me thinking at that time that it's something that needs to be addressed. It gets to the heart of this notion of reductive materialism. And now with synthetic biology, we're tackling these problems on a very practical basis. What does it all mean? How do you understand life, and what ultimately makes life sacred? I can tell you that scientists aren't particularly good at answering that question either. I've gone through the literature. There are literally hundreds of papers that deal with the question, what's the definition of life? And they're not particularly illuminating. One interesting paper I came across was actually a review of the literature on the subject. And they claim to have gone through the entire literature, and they found 123 different non-redundant definitions of life in the scientific literature. In the end, all we can say is that we know it when we see it, more or less, with some debate still open to that. But what about from the Torah perspective? Is there a Torah understanding of what life is, and how does that mesh with the notion of human beings being able to create living organisms, being able to create life? Is this something that's within our bailiwick? In the brief time I have here today, I'm not going to pretend that I'm giving an exhaustive survey of this particular topic. There's enormous amounts written that are related to it. But I just wanted to highlight a few interesting perspectives. If you look at the sheets, the first item is from Rav Sadia Gaon, Emunot V'Deot. He writes, he gives his interesting perspective on what the nefesh is all about, that the nefesh he and many others equate with life. He starts, "V'kol atzma etzem bahir k'behira tagilgalim." The essence of what the soul is something incredibly pure, very fine, like the purity or the fineness of the heavenly spheres. Again, understanding that the planets and the heavens all rotated through heavenly spheres. And he receives the divine light the celestial light, the divine light, the silver sea, is the same way that the celestial spheres would do so. Except that the soul, the nefesh, is finer in some respects than the celestial spheres, so it actually gets more of the light. And this is what enables the soul to be intelligent, to be communicative. V'ani gati l'chach al yedei shnei yisodos hagdolim, chlatana muskal v'hu masharaiti mehashpat chachmata v'anagtal etzachei aguf, v'raiti shaguf eru mikol ze bizman kriyato mimena. And he says that the first thing he looks at, interestingly enough, is not the psukim. He thinks about it from almost an experimentalist perspective. He sees what the soul is capable of in terms of taking care of the needs of the body. What the soul is capable of thinking, what the soul is capable of communicating, what the soul is capable of from an intellectual perspective to take care of the body. And how that is missing when the soul leaves the body. Ve'ilu haita kamoa chalachin sheba olam ha'sefel lo haita ose ma'uma min apulos ha'nikpado salalam. And he says that if you were to consider the soul as a part of the material world, as part of the world that it interacts with, to simply be a material object like everything else and connected to the material world, he says he cannot fathom how it would be possible for the soul to accomplish all of that, because that's not the nature of material things. Material things are manipulated, they don't manipulate. That's not the nature. So this is his perspective, that the soul, that life itself is something ephemeral. It's created by God, but it's not part of the material world. It's not associated with it. And he goes on to, again, state his understanding of the soul, which, by the way, is very much related to the perspective of Greek philosophers as well, as he himself points out later on. He says that the soul is a single entity that consists of three different kochos, three different attributes. He says the nefesh, which he associates with taiva, with appetite, with a need to accumulate things and to grow from them. Then there's the ruach, which he associates with kas, with anger, with emotion, with action. And then finally the neshama, which is associated with wisdom. He holds that they're all one part of one entity, but just different attributes. This perspective evolved by the time of the Rishonim. The Rishonim understood it a little bit differently, and they base it very much, their perspective, on the psukim that are reported in Bereishit, which I copied a few down here. If you look at on the right side, in item number 2, Vayom Elokim, Tadzea Aretz, Desher Esav Mazria, Zera Eitz Pri Yosef Pri, Lemino Asher, Zarubo Ala Aretz Vayichem. So he says, the pasuk says, let the earth bring forth all sorts of vegetation. Let the earth bring forth all sorts of vegetation. And then it continues, Atotze Aretz, and the earth did bring forth, again, all this vegetation. Contrast that with the way animal life is described, the creation of animal life on the other side. Vayom Elokim, Yishritzu Amayim Sheretz, Nefesh Chaya. It uses the expression Nefesh Chaya, a living soul. Let the water swarm with living souls. Va'of yofef al aretz al pnei rakiya shemayim. And it continues, Va'yivra alakim et hataninim. God made the great sea monsters, hagdolim. Ve'kol nefesh achaya. Again, that expression, nefesh achaya, the living soul. It's missing from the account of the vegetative matter. Just the let the earth give forth vegetation, but there's no mention of nefesh at all, much less a nefesh chaya. Right? And then later, in the second account of Hashem's creation of man, it says, Vayitzar Hashem Elokim et Adam, Efer min Adama, Vayifach ba'apav nishmat chayim. So again, God made man from the dust, from the ground, and he blew into his nostrils the soul of life. Nishmas chayim vayihi Adam lenefesh chaya. And man, again, that same term, became a living soul. A living soul. So this is what Rishonim had to work with. And again, I'm just using the Ramban as an example, although there are others as well that discuss this. But if you look at item number 3, this is the Ramban. He starts by saying, Vayitachen sheyirmoz ba'aretz hanizkeret b'pasuk harishon. So he says, first of all, one of the things that the Ramban holds is that the only creation ex nihilo, the only creation from nothing, something from nothing, occurs on the first day of creation. God creates the universe on the first day of creation. He creates the world on the first day of creation. When it says, you know, Breshis bara Elokim et hashamayim v'et haaretz. That's the account of creation. Everything else, he says, evolves from that, is created from that. So Vayitachen sheyirmoz ba'aretz in his keret b'pasuk harishon sheyimashech mimena koach matzmiach. When God created the earth on the first day of creation, he included within it the properties that would enable it to give forth living things, to give forth vegetative matter, things that would grow. V'nei netzlu mikocha yisodos l'mineim v'mehem tzamchu b'gan Eden d'sayim v'ilanos v'mehem ba'olam. These things ultimately on the third day would give rise to various forms of vegetation, initially in Gan Eden, and then from there would spread all over the world. But the key thing is that the properties of matter, the properties of the world itself, the property of the world was such that it would be capable of deriving at least this type of living thing. However, in discussing the psukim on the third day, if you look at the second paragraph there, he makes an important distinction, a very, very important distinction. Lo hizkir b'shlishi b'tzameach nefesh klal. Right? On the third day, when it's discussed the creation of vegetable matter, the pasuk never uses the expression nefesh, soul. Lo nefesh chaya v'lo nefesh stam. Not the living soul, not any kind of soul. Ki ein koach hagidul nefesh. He says the property of growth, the property of sprouting, this has nothing to do with a soul. It's not life in the same way that we're accustomed to using it. Rak b'balei atnua bilvadhi. Only in those organisms that move, that are active, that seek things, that have those properties that Rav Sadia Gaon associated with the nefesh. These are the things that actually have a living soul. Valdas ha'yivanim she'omim k'shem she'en agidul mitnoeya rak b'nefesh. Now, he quotes here the Greeks, and particularly he's referring to Plato and Aristotle, who go at great lengths to discuss their perception of what the soul is all about. They say that there has to be a soul in everything that we perceive as living, including vegetative matter. All right, that it doesn't have to be in the mobile. All right, so they say that it has to have a nefesh. Kach betzameach benefesh yigdal, that in order for something to grow, it has to have this life force associated with it. Yeh hefresh, but he says there's this distinction. Kizot nefesh chaya kloma nefesh sheyesh bo chiyus. So he's again making a distinction. With vegetative matter, with plants, they're capable of growth. They might, according to the Greeks, perhaps he's willing to give them that, although he doesn't think it's the case. They might have a nefesh of some sort, but not a nefesh of life, not a nefesh of chiyus. It's different. It's on a different madrega. Right? And he refers to it as the nefesh tzomechet, the vegetative soul. So there's a basic distinction that's being made by the Rambam between very simple forms of life and more complex forms of life, both in terms of what this nefesh is and where it comes from. The nefesh, again, the thing that the property of growth is something that's inherent in the material, but the nefesh itself comes from elsewhere. Where does that come from? He explains in the third part here where he discusses the creation of man. V'apshat ha'nachon milat naseh, because again it says, V'yom alakim naseh ha'adam, let us make man. What does it mean? Mipnei shekvar reit al adat ki alakim bara yesh me'ayin b'yom rishon levado. Again, as we pointed out before, the Ramban holds that God created something from nothing only on the first day. V'akachach mina yisoda sehem anivrim yatsar v'asar. Everything else came from the material created on the first day. V'kasha natan b'mayim koach hasheretz lishrotz nefesh chaya v'yam mama b'hem yishritzu amayim. When he talks about how the waters were given the property that living things should emerge from them, a nefesh chaya v'yam mama b'behema totzei aretz, and also with regard to animals, that the earth should give forth these things. Ama ba'adam, in those cases, these things are being derived entirely from existing matter. They're being entirely derived from the material with which the world is created. Man, however, is different. Ama ba'adam naseh, klomar, ani v'ha'aretz hanizkeret naseh adam. God himself, together with the earth, will create man. Shatotzia aretz guf miyosedeh, the earth will give rise to its body. Kasher astah ba'behema v'chaya, the same way it was with the animals. Kedichtiv vayitzar Hashem elokim et ha'adam afar min ha'adama, vayiten hu yitbarach haruach mipi elyon. The animative soul, the higher soul, not even getting to the neshama here, but the animative soul, that which gives a person their ability to function, to live, the things that would make an animal distinct from a plant. This is something that he says is derived directly from God, at least in the case of human beings. Not necessarily clear that he would hold that true of animals. It may also be derived from the material part of the world, but there's something unique about man that's derived specifically from God. And there are many others who developed this notion. The Vilna Gaon, again looking at the next items, the Vilna Gaon followed this idea, although he again further developed the notion that the different components of Rav Sadia Gaon referred to, the nefesh, the ruach, and the neshama, and which already in the Ramban's time had been largely accepted as three separate entities, three different types of souls. He develops this further and says that there exists on different madregas. Right? And just to summarize what's he's saying outside for a moment. He says that there are three different madregas. The lowest level is the level of the nefesh. This, he says, is associated, he associates the nefesh with plant life. He says they too have a nefesh. But the nefesh is derived from the earth. It's derived from the material matter in which this planet is made. That's where it comes from. The ruach he associates with animal life, specifically associated with animal life. But the ruach, he says, is derived from the air. Animals need air to breathe. And it's derived from the air, but it's still derived from part of the material world. The neshama, which is unique to human beings, that, he says, is derived from God himself, derived mishamayim, it's derived from heaven. Only human beings have a neshama. But the ruach, the part, that animative soul, that's characteristic of all living things, he says it's the same in people as it is in animals. The only difference being the neshama that's divine that comes to us. And the neshama, remembered, is that part of the soul, or that soul, he understands them as three separate souls, as that soul that is specifically associated with our intelligence, with our spirituality, with our ability to communicate one to another, and so on. It's distinct from the general life force. The general life force itself is something that could be derived from the created world, something that's derived from the material. All right, we'll come back to this item number 6, which is also to grow a little bit later, and try and understand the practical implications of some of this. But I just wanted to show you one more perspective, and that of Rav Hirsch, who also has some very interesting things to say about this. He says, "B'shah shabah chadosh baruch l'barat ba'alei achayim, amar yishritzu amayim sheretz nefesh chaya." The time when Hashem came to create the animal kingdom, he said again, let the waters swarm with the living souls, with the sheretz nefesh chaya. Totzei aretz nefesh chaya. And also with regard to the animals, let the earth give forth the nefesh chaya, the living soul. Vayihichen. Kasher bebriyas hatzmachim, ken bebriyas ha'balei chayim, Lo pala raka aretz, v'yasam imrucham imena hayu, v'im harasam, v'hialdasam, v'komasam, v'tzivyonim u'shlemusam, lo ken b'yitziras adam. So he's saying here that again, he's not making here a distinction between the vegetative matter and the animal matter. He's sort of pulling them all together, that they're both their nefesh, their basic life force, as well as their ruach, their the thing that makes them mobile animals, they're all derived from nature. They're all derived from the earth. All right? But it's different with people. Lo levad b'yitziras nafsho, kin gam b'yitziras gviyaso, lo pala adama me'uma, rak Hashem levado yatzra asa v'yikoneh. God was involved not only in our creation of our neshama, but also other aspects of it. There are things that make humans distinct. He goes a little bit further in the grab, more so than just the neshama. Mina adama lo lakach ha-kadosh baruch hu rak etachomer hadrush liyitzirat tagviya. From the earth, all he took was the basic materials, the basic building blocks that were necessary to form our bodies. Avaloa tanefesh hachaya, but not the vital spirit, that essential element that gives us life. Right? And he goes on and on about this, basically saying that humans are distinct. Somehow humans have to be viewed differently, that not only the neshama, but the ruach also comes directly from God. All the things, if it wasn't for God breathing into Adam's nostril, he would have been left as a golem, basically an unformed lump of clay, an unformed piece of matter that had no life in it. So he's making here a clear distinction between humanity and the animal kingdom. And then in this other quote here from Rav Hirsch, he does address vegetative matter there, and in terms of saying that it's distinct from animal matter, not having a nefesh. A nefesh, he says, characterizes organisms that exist as a whole. A plant you can chop up and you get, you know, 10 pieces, you'll get 10 plants. You can do it. It's not something that it constitutes a complete unique organism. But I don't want to spend the time to go into that right now. I want to discuss for a moment, what are the significance of this perspective? Is it related to some of the issues that we're talking about? One of the first issues, of course, as far as synthetic biology is concerned, is it even possible? Do we have the ability and the right given to us by God to go and create life, something which until this moment was something that was unique and pertained only to Him? Is that something that's even feasible for us to do? And it would seem from this understanding that on some level, why not? If the properties that are responsible for relatively simple living organisms are biological properties that are dependent upon the properties of matter, on biochemical reactions, on generating sufficient biochemically derived energy, on genetics, why not? If that's the source of their basic life force. Humans, though, would seem to be a little bit different. But first, go back to that quote that we skipped over from the Gra, item number 6 on the sheet. He discusses here, remember, man is the first instruction that man is given, is mil'ua ta'aretz v'kivshua. And the Vilna Gaon explains, what does that exactly mean? Kivshua? We can do with the world what we want. Whatever enters our hearts, whatever enters our minds, whatever it is that we think we can do, whatever we seek to achieve, we're given a heter to go ahead and do it. Hein laharos, even if it means destruction, even if it means destroying the world, and also to investigate, to search out, to study the world, to try and understand it better, and also to open and to plow and to work the land, to work the ground so that it provides us with our basic needs. This is the Vilna Gaon's understanding of Kivshua. And so from his perspective, it would seem that there shouldn't be a problem. He goes on to say, "Uradu b'dgatayam ba'ofa shemayim u'b'chol chaya arameshet ala aretz." When the pasuk says that we're to rule over basically all living things, it says perish nefesh chaya, all aspects of life, all things that have in it the living force. Ketagamovu kol kolma shenivra meha aretz behema v'chaya v'remesh. This would include all living things that are derived from the earth. So, from the perspective of the Gra, there shouldn't be a particular issue in terms of going ahead with synthetic biology, presumably in creating life. Amazingly, even to the point that we have the heter to destroy the world, if that's what we seek to do so. There are other opinions and there are ways of getting into that. I don't want to give this halachic opinion as to whether we should go and destroy the world, but it's just interesting the language that he used. There are objections, though, raised from other sources. If you look at item number 9, this is from the Gemara in Tainus. It says, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Shlosha maftechot beyado shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. God holds three keys in his hand, meaning that these are things that presumably are exclusively in the hands of God. That he did not hand over to anybody else, to any messenger, to any intermediary, in other words, to another human being. And these are them. Mafteach shel geshamim, control of the rain. Mafteach shel chaya, the key of chaya, which can be understood as life, although as the Gemara explains a little bit further down, is understood really as conception of conceiving a child, umafteach shel tchias hametim, and the key to the restoring the dead, to restoring the dead to life. Of course, you can raise questions on this Gemara, and both Rashi and Tosfos do. Obvious questions. Well, the Tanakh is full of stories of people who had these abilities. We know, for example, both Eliyahu and Elisha raised the dead. We know if people are able to mispalo and to, you know, get God to open up the wombs, and these are things that we're still doing. Or to Eliyahu control the rain as well. I mean, these are things that happen. So both Rashi and Tosfos raise these questions. Rashi responds that, well, all three were never given to a single person all at the same time. Okay? Tosfos says that they were never given to be permanently held by a human being. Ways of understanding it. The point being, though, is that the Gemara may have more sophisticated, more subtle points that it's trying to make here. But even based on the initial understanding, the initial reaction of Rishonim, is that it's not necessarily meant to be understood that under no circumstances are these things ever to be given into the hands of human beings. Because we know that there are exceptions to that. Right. In fact, the Gemara itself provides some enigmatic stories, anecdotes, of instances where people did create living things. If you look at the Gemara in Sanhedrin, item number 10 here, Rava bara gavra, right? Rava created a man. Dari lakami de Rav Zera, so he created this being, this man, and he sent him over to Rabbi Zera to go before him. Havikamishtai bahade velo havikamahadale. So Rabbi Zera tried to engage in conversation. He tried to speak to this thing that Rava had sent over, and he wasn't able to respond. So he said to it, "Min chavreyat, you come from the chavra. You come from the rabbis. I recognize you as something that they created." And again, Rashi explains he created through the means of the Sefer Yetzirah, through Kabbalistic approaches. And then he tells him, Hadal Afrecha, return to the dust from which you came. The Maharshar explains that the neshama, which again is responsible for our cognition, responsible for making us intelligent beings, responsible for our ability to communicate, it's the nefesh ha-medaberet, that is something that was beyond anybody's ability to create. That's something that's outside the hands of a human being. right? And lefi she'ein bo neshama shehu haruach ha'ola lamala rak ruach ha'chiyoni shigam ken bebehema. I read it lamata. The only thing this thing had was the same spirit that would be found in an animal, the lower spirits. Amalei hadalaf recha, return to your dust. Then Gemara goes on with a second story as well. Immediately following this, it says Rav Chanina v'Rav Oshia havu yasfei kol malei shavta v'aske b'sefer yitzira. So Rav Chanina and Rav Oshia would get together every Erev Shabbos, and they would also engage in the Sefer Yitzira, which is again a very important Kabbalistic work. Mivolahu igla tilsa. They created a fully mature, full-grown calf, a calf that was basically equivalent to a three-year-old calf. Right? Va'achleila. And they would have that, they would shecht it, and that would be, I guess, their meal on Shabbos. The Pitchei Tshuvan, commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, points out that this creature that was created has perhaps some unique halachic standings. Right, if you look at the item number 12, the Pitchei Tshuva, the behema, it's called Chatav the behema she nivrat al yedei sefer yitzira, kamo de matzino begemara de bara agla tilsa bekol ara shabbos muta la achlo baodo chai. You know, there's an iser eva menachai. You're not allowed to eat. You're not allowed to take a limb off a living animal and eat it as such. It's considered a particular act of cruelty. But if you happen to go, instead of buying your meat at the nearest butcher store, you go and you create a calf with the Sefer Yetzirah, this thing doesn't quite have the same status, and therefore the halacha doesn't pertain to it. And he goes on, in fact, here to quote that the famous Medrash that says that when Yosef went and complained about his brothers to Yaakov. He wanted, according to one medrash, what he complained about was the fact that they were eating ever minachai. And it was, in fact, according to Pitkei Tshuva, that what they were doing was again, creating animals using the Sefer Yetzirah. They held that it was permissible to eat. Yosef held that it's not permissible to eat. Why? He points here that b'kol makom aso achlo b'lo shchita midrabanan mishum marasayin. Right? It wouldn't look good if you went and started eating ever menachai. Not everybody would understand that this was something. These sources are interesting in terms of just reflecting on the perspective of what the Jewish attitude towards living things are. You have different madregas, you have different levels. There's nothing in Judaism, I haven't found a single source that would completely obviate the possibility that human beings can create life from biological mechanisms. Or would say that such a thing necessarily is asur, because it's somehow acting like God, it's playing God or doing something or extending too much hubris. There's obviously a certain amount of responsibility with it. It does have certain implications, though, in terms of how we view living things. We can view living things perhaps a little bit more mechanistically. However, in every single source that I've come across, and this just skims the top, there's always a distinction made between lower forms of life and human beings, humanity. There's a different aspect to us. And this, by the way, is something that you find itself in the secular literature as well. Lower forms of life we can experiment on. People do experiments on C. elegans, they do experiments on rats, on mice, all sorts of things. And there's a justification for it. On human beings, you can't do it. There's a sense of morality, there's something protective about it. We believe that human beings have a particular spiritual essence that they get directly from the divine, directly from Hashem. If you look at the last page, and I always hesitate to show this because it's a horrible source for anything. This is from a book, Thinking Out Loud, Thinking Aloud, which basically quotes, you know, without permission, to my best of my knowledge, conversations that were held with Rav Soloveitchik by David and Barry Holzer, and they basically recorded these things either in writing or tape recorded it, and then they reported what it was he said in answer to all sorts of questions on a variety of different topics. They don't reflect any effort on the Rav's part to really seriously think through these issues or to address them in the way in which he was so characteristic of him to do so, so precisely and so thoroughly, and to think it through completely. But I did find it very interesting when somebody showed this to me, in that he had this very same conversation about this topic, where they start off with the psukim in Bereishit, and they ask him what it means, and he understands it to mean something very biological. He says that there seems to be a conflict on the part of those who hold that living things can be explained simply by their biology, and others who believe that there has to be some sort of vitalistic component to it. And he says he doesn't understand the need to insert a vitalistic component of it, something ephemeral, something supernatural. He says it wouldn't bother him in the least if we can go ahead and we can create life, if we can demonstrate that life is simply a question of basic biology, of basic science. That doesn't bother him. He says where he draws the line is where everyone else draws the line. He says, when you get to try and understand the spiritual nature of man, the element that's the neshama, he says it's a fundamental cardinal belief in Judaism. This is something different. This is something unique. That this is something that's somehow separate and cannot be explained simply by biology. The Rav is not alone in this. And neither are religious people. You go through the literature, you read Roger Penrose, for example. Roger Penrose is someone who writes about consciousness, ability to be self-aware. Roger Penrose is, of course, a very well-known mathematical physicist who worked closely with Stephen Hawking in understanding the thermodynamics of black holes. And someone who's, since doing that work in black holes, has focused a lot of his attention on the understanding consciousness, understanding awareness in human beings. And he's come to the conclusion that there is no simple biological algorithmic explanation. The belief that the brain is simply a complicated computer wouldn't be able to follow it, and you could reduce everything to algorithms, he says, just does not hold water. And he's written two extremely interesting books on the subject, which I could discuss in a lot more detail, but I'm out of time. And he postulates, he instead goes to something even more mysterious. He tries to postulate quantum mechanics as having something to do with this. And then some people say that what he's doing is taking one thing nobody understands and substituting with something else nobody understands. And that could very well be true. But the fact is that this is something, our ability to be self-aware, to have subjective experience, to have a spiritual relationship, to think abstractly, all these things are things that are not easily understood through simple biological mechanisms. To generate a bacteria, to generate a eukaryotic cell, to do all sorts of things, probably, and as the years unfold, to generate eukaryotic organisms, plants, simple animals, it's not as mysterious, and the way the science is moving forward, it's going to happen. And it's going to happen, you know, probably for most of our lifetimes, that we're going to see this thing emerge. But to get to the point where you understand what makes a human being uniquely human, that's something that biology is never going to be able to explain. And that, I think, is still a source, ultimately, to having complete emunah in the notion of the sanctity of life, that life is sacred, at least human life. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Dr. Edsel. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Again, our next Clear and Reach will be on November 22nd. Have a great day.
That was terrific. I'm way out of my depth.